I'm Lawrence Pintack. I'm the dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication. This is kind of a variation of what they call the consensus conference. And in that, we're only going to have a couple of actual presentations, this one by Frieda Ray being one of them, as basically starting points. We'll have two to start with in this session, and then later on in the session on media, we'll have our team from Murrow, Doug Hindman and Michael Beam, present results of a survey they did of news access in the state of Washington. We are taping this for Northwest Public Radio. The entire, whatever it is, 8 hours are not going to air, I can assure you. As Kerry Swanson, the station manager, vigorously confirms. But we will edit it down into a series of shows. And we're also looking at this as the possibility of this being a first step in a smaller series of kind of town halls around this issue that we might move around the state. And so we're looking at that possibility with some funders. I must say, I am not a native of this region. I'm one of those Northeast guys who's an interloper. And in coming in, and particularly I think the first time I drove from here to Seattle, which as many of you know can be a pretty mind-numbing experience in parts. I was amazed at how little was out there, first of all, my naivete of the state of Washington. You know, all of us Easterners think of the state of Washington as Seattle and the coast, etc. I'm sure you've all seen the classic old New Yorker cover cartoon of the world according to a New Yorker, and it's Fifth Avenue and the Hudson River and this little strip of New Jersey and then a vast wasteland in the Pacific Ocean. we don't really think that way, but I have been in, you know, as dean of this college and looking at the mediascape here and then at the technology infrastructure here, I really have been amazed and a bit appalled at the what I call information black holes in the state. And that's obviously an overgeneralization, but the number of towns that do not have a newspaper or a radio station that actually provides local news, because we all know there are radio stations that are centrally programmed and the building may burn down, but they're never going to be able to report that the building burned down. So we've been looking at this issue for a while in various ways. And about 6 months ago, I got a call from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which many of you know is actually a foundation that I've done. I do a variety of work with on different projects. And there's something called the Carnegie Knight Initiative for the Future of Journalism. It's been around for a few years, maybe 5 years or so. And it's 12 of the elite, in quotes, journalism schools who have been funded by Carnegie and the Knight Foundation to try and figure out where journalism is going. And then it's taken a few other side turns into other related projects. And the initiative is actually kind of phasing out. But this last project they're doing, and now we're doing, is a look at the FCC information needs report that came out last summer, and many of you are familiar with it. It came out, and there was a thump, and then it disappeared. And so what they decided, and Knight helped fund this report, by the way, so they had a stake in this. So they said, let's take these 12 schools and have them look at different aspects of the report, get conversations going on a local and regional level around aspects of this report. And much to our good luck, Northwestern wasn't able to participate, so we were asked to step in as the 12th school. So what we've done is we're organizing this conversation and then this research piece that Mike and Doug are doing. And after a series, others are doing various parts of the report. We're specifically looking at the rural issue, rural information access, which obviously is a logical thing to be looking at in this state. And then we, the 12 deans, will all meet at Harvard in June and produce a joint report on all of the issues we've looked at and a set of recommendations. So what the hope is today is to have this conversation. And again, this is a moderated conversation. So other than these three presentations, for each session, I'm going to ask one or two people or three people who come from that area, for example, the media session, you know, Mike Shepard and a couple of other people from the media, to talk about media issues. But that's only as a starting point, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes of informal talk to set up a broader conversation. And all of you, I want to be taking part in all of these sessions where you have something to contribute and want to take part. So again, it's a conversation, it's not a speech. With that, let me introduce Frieda Ray. Some of you know there is a state broadband office. And when we first started looking at this a couple of years ago, I looked at some fascinating data that the state broadband office, in the guise of a different person who's sitting at this table, had produced. And Frieda has brought us some maps. Well, I won't steal your thunder, but we have some interesting data to look at about broadband penetration. Frieda Ray.
Thank you. I think I'll move to the center, if that's all right.
I'll also say, as you walk up, we are some of our students here somewhere are doing some live tweets of this. And if anyone tweets and wants to live do any tweeting on this, the hashtag, correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, the hashtag is hashtag Murrow12, right?
Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, for those of you who have not memorized the bio, I want to apologize. This is a broadcast format, and I was a print journalist. So, cut me some slack here. But this will be quick, brevity being the soul of wit. I'll start with thanking you, of course, for inviting me. This is going to be an important discussion for our state and, of course, the future of media. And we're happy to contribute what we can to that wealth of information. Also, the heart of our work is not just about the technology, but about what broadband enables in the way of benefits for health, education, public safety, and so forth. So this speaks right to the heart of our mission. This is, we talk a little bit about what we do and how we arrived, how we got a state broadband office. But basically, nationally, $4.7 billion was awarded through ARRA funding for projects that included infrastructure build-out. Some of the folks that are working on that are represented here, public computer centers, and sustainable adoption programs. All 50 states also received a state broadband data and development grant to establish a state office and charged with integrating broadband into local and state economies. This is broadband in a slide. There are people here who know it way better than I do. But basically, in case general audience sees this, we should know that broadband is typically measured in speed. Speed is the amount of time it takes data to move from one place to another. And it's usually expressed in megabits per second, although we can get into the kilobits and gigabits later. This is from the FCC's own site about uses and needs. If you look at the very low end, it's just 1 to 2 megabits per second. When we get into multiple users and multiple high data consumption uses, we're down into the 15 megabits per second. But basically, just wanted to kind of give people a brief overview of speeds necessary to do certain tasks, and to also make sure that people understood that is often expressed in different, in an upload and a download speed, typically in different numbers or asymmetrical form, and it's delivered through DSL, cable modem, fiber optic cable, fixed or mobile wireless, and satellite. This is our broadband map. One of our primary functions is to maintain this map. The map represents the voluntary contribution of service area data by 112 providers from around the state. This map, purple, indicates where wireless is squished. Our state is actually wider than that. And the green is wireline. Typically, the wireline is overlaying wireless. You can pretty much assume there's wireless underneath that green. The map is updated every 6 months, and there is an update coming up at the end of this month. This also should point out is at 768, which is the NTIA's very minimum definition of broadband. However, we know that the map is not perfect, and so we gather consumer feedback from through our state map. In this case, the map data actually goes straight to the mapping vendor, takes that information and works with providers to clarify coverage areas where there seems to be some dispute. In all fairness, some of the areas where there's a problem have to do with the way that the grant requires the mapping data be supplied, and It's kind of complex, has to do with census blocks and so forth. The national broadband map also collects data. So if a consumer in Washington State goes through our map or the national map, we will get that feedback. We will get it to the vendor. We'll work through the problem. Here's the good news. The map data indicates that 96.1% of Washington households have access to 3 megabits or more. And that is access to now or could have access in 7 days, I believe, is the reporting standard. And nearly 79% of the population have access to 25 megabits, which is the 12th highest percentage of the population with access at that level in the nation. There's more good news. More than 1.3 million broadband connections are in use in Washington State already, 7th highest in the nation. And we have the 3rd highest adoption rate in the nation, with 77% adoption rate. And our urban and rural split, which is an issue, kind of speaks to what your symposium is about, is about 9%. If you go to states like, I think Missouri has a, it's almost a 50% split. It's,
what do you mean by a split?
When you compare the adoption rate in an urban area, it'd be about 75 or so, or 77, and then it'd be 9% less in urban, in rural areas in our state. So compared to other states, it's not, the urban-rural divide isn't quite as bad as you might think. Also, we have more infrastructure on the way. Build-outs, Noah Annette will recognize the plowing picture here. Build-outs of middle mile and last mile infrastructure continue through this year. And a substantial part of the $165 million worth of federally funded build-outs should be completed this year. Since the ARRA grants were awarded, more than 740 miles of fiber optic have been installed, and another 850 miles are planned before the grant period runs out. Private investment is also robust, with investments of $80 million and $40 million by CenturyLink and Frontier, respectively. I think Frontier just announced that they've spent $78 million of that already. And head-to-head wireless competition for 4G LTE networks between Verizon and AT and other wireless have also helped. We do still have gaps. This is a map of unserved areas by geography. So the thing to remember is that this is miles. When you look at population, however, just 3.88% of the state's households have no access to broadband, and another 2.3% have access at less than 3 megabits. Many of these areas are either sparsely populated, 20 people per square mile or less, or have high rates of poverty, or both. For instance, Yakima, Grays Harbor, Whatcom, Ferry, and Clallam County all have areas with no broadband provider, yet for every 100 people in that county, 34 to 50 are clients of DSH for either economic, vocational, or medical services.
When you say access, you mean it's available?
It is available. There doesn't mean they're hooked up.
Right.
So what are we doing about it? Well, we are launching our local technology planning team grant program. We're granting a total of $300,000 a year for 2 grant cycles, with the individual grants between $50,000 and $100,000. For communities to develop a plan for broadband deployment adoption in their community. We expect that some of that planning will include communities making a business case for broadband where there is not broadband now. We also have universal service reform. And there are a lot of people in this room who have lots of different opinions about it. Again, really briefly, basically, the rules that of universal service reform were changed to create a Connect America Fund and a Mobility Fund. Connect America is to direct broadband to unserved areas. Mobility is to support mobile broadband, with a requirement that fund recipients must provide 3G service in 2 years or 4G in 3. This rule also has set up a special fund, one-time fund, for mobility mobile wireless build-out in tribal areas. Also, since the report, Net Zero has announced that they are providing free 4G wireless on the Clearwire infrastructure, It does have the free, has a cap, of course, but they've announced that they're adding it to 10 cities in Washington State. Freedom Pop says they're going to pull out a similar program as well. Also, both Comcast and CenturyLink introduced a low-income program for broadband access with a $9.95 monthly rate. They started out both at 1.5 megabits. Comcast has upped the ante to 3 megabits since the report. So what's the new digital divide? It's about speed. And I want to give a story based on, we're from the Department of Commerce, so it's a business story. We have the Buggy Barn in Reardon, which has a lovely site, and as a quilter, I must go. But they actually ship nationally and internationally based on the traffic they get on their website. However, they do demonstration videos, which is kind of important in quilting. They have to go into town and upload the video to YouTube because they don't have a speed connection fast enough there. And, of course, when they go back to their shop, they can't watch it. Conversely, A Touch of Dutch in Coopville, very seasonal business selling, as you might imagine, Dutch items, including shipping them overseas. In fact, they have shipped stuff to Holland, which I find amusing. However, for a long time, she was saying, I've got great service here, but I can't work at home. As a small business owner, this is a problem. In the last year, because of broadband upgrades, she has sufficient speed at home to handle the website of her business at home. It accounts for about 30% of her income and makes her seasonal business year-round. She's quite happy with it. Next challenge is living in Lyman. It's not really living in Lyman, but it is. The challenge is the issue of symmetrical and asymmetrical broadband. We have talked to a gentleman by the name of Ryan Jefferson. He happens to be a senior software development engineer from Microsoft. So why is he living in Lyman? He has these cows, Old Hereford beef cattle. What he does for a living with Microsoft requires video conferencing to engineers in Redmond, China, India, and Sweden. However, he can't exactly relocate because you can't raise a cow in Redmond. So his challenge is how the connections work for him, right? He would like to have more speed, obviously, but the more demand he places on the symmetrical and asymmetrical kinds of systems, the more likely he is to eventually need symmetrical or more like symmetrical coverage. And so I guess I would raise this as sort of the question you kick around going forward, is what does this mean when we talk about citizen journalist and content creation, especially if you're having some kind of two-way conversation? Symmetrical helps quite a bit. So it may be the next thing to work on beyond.
Because we have non-specialists, these guys know what you're talking about. Explain symmetrical and non-symmetrical.
You have upload and download speeds, and typically your download speed is actually faster. Developed out of that idea that we were consumers of things on the internet and videos and so forth. And upload is typically a lower bandwidth. Symmetrical would be a one-for-one. There are parts of Grant County, for instance, where they told us last year that they're delivering 100 megabits symmetrical to households, or can deliver that to households. So those folks can do high-def video conferencing and have somebody else play in a game, and they're good to go. What I'm concerned about, or what I think we need to be thinking about as a state, is what does that look like over the long term as we get online, all of our kids get online, you know, we start reporting from Reardon. What does it look like? What are our needs going to be? And that's pretty much it. You can reach us any number of ways. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Our maps are all at our website. They're interactive. You can enter your address, play around with them, see who covers it, see what speeds they cover it at.
Great. Thank you. Are there questions for Frieda while she's... Angela Wu used to be in Frieda's office and is now working with a nonprofit, or runs a nonprofit, that works on this issue in terms of access on the local level. So, Angela, what do you have for us?
Well, first we have to get my presentation.
Oh, well, minor detail. Tell them while you're doing that, tell them a little bit about
you. I was going to say, while we're setting up the few slides I brought, I'm going to set the expectations here of where I'm coming from, which is, so I have my iPhone, I have my my tablet, my iPad, and I have my Mac Air and my laptop. At home, my son has Microsoft Connect, and he is a gamer and plays internationally, and my daughter has Wii, and I participate in it with her. My excuse is that it's exercise, it's not about the fun. So I've got about every single device out there in the market in my home that we use every day. And we are very fortunate in Seattle that we have the broadband speeds that enable us to use all these devices. So when I share my perspective on all of this, you'll have to understand where I'm coming from, is that I'm definitely one of not the first adopters, but I am definitely in the early adopter regime. So Larry asked me to tell you a little bit about my nonprofit. When I was working for the state, we conducted workshops, Frida and I, all around the state to get a feel for, do people even understand what is technology, and do they want it, and if they do, how are they going to use it, and what are their barriers in the way? And we repeatedly heard from people that they really needed tech-skilled workforce from within the community, not people coming there, helping them set them up, and then leave, because then it's not sustainable. And so I really heard and thought about this quite a bit, and what I did was, when I left the state, was start a nonprofit. And I just got my 501c3 from the IRS, and it is to connect tech-savvy students to small businesses, get them a paid internship so they get applied work experience, and they help the small businesses get their online presence, and then help them sustain it and keep it fresh. And the idea is that as small businesses understand the value and impact of this, they then have a business reason to hire those kids as employees, and there you start the initial tech workforce from within the community, and you can build from that and hopefully attract more tech-skilled companies that need tech skills, and as well as seed innovation and entrepreneurial spirit out in these communities. All right, so my presentation is up. So I have my digital notes here on my iPad. I can't tell you how much I love the fact that we've got broadband here on the campus. I don't know what I would do without broadband, honestly. So first I'd like to say good morning to everyone, and that it is truly lovely to be back here in Pullman, Washington. Eastern Washington is a very beautiful part of our state, and I've really enjoyed getting to know it better and look forward to visiting here more. I also appreciate Professor Pintak's invitation for me to come here and share some of my thoughts, actually Dean, on digital media, and for a roundtable discussion. So I'm really just going to be kind of jump-starting everybody's minds around this issue. There are many subject matter experts already here, but for the context of the entire room, I just wanted to kind of get us all on the same playing field. So our job here is to share our collective experiences and knowledge and discuss how rural areas in our state can continue to be informed communities in this digital age, to have the information and news that they need to take advantage of life's opportunities, as well as participate in our government. I have three burning questions that I have for the group at large, and I'll explain why they came to mind for me, and also share with you some creative thoughts that I have about how we might address this important topic. You'll think that I'm very much of an out-of-the-box thinker, so I get very creative with some of this, but I also borrow from the experiences of others of tried and true ideas as well. So here's the first question. Do you think technology is creating a digital class of citizens with privileges that are not available to others in our state? That's question one. Question two. Do we know if rural communities are sufficiently digitally literate across our state to access news and information, not just for now, but going forward into the 21st century, whatever that may include? Third, if communities need to become digitally literate, then how can they accomplish this given today's economic realities and challenges? So just some food for thought for our discussion today. So let's begin with a short overview, starting with defining who is the digital class. To many communities, they seem like aliens from another world. Companies full of techie people who won't wear suits, because it's not about what you wear, but it's about how smart you are. They don't play politics, because they rather focus on solving problems. And they think in code about how to build a virtual image of our world and expect the rest of us to keep up. Think Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Twitter, our startup communities all over the nation, let alone other countries, as examples. This growing class of citizens is one side of the digital divide, first defined as the have versus have-nots, and now further refined as digital adopters or digital natives. Digital adopters are people who did not grow up with technology, but learned it because they had to, typically for a job. And then you have digital natives, people like our children and our grandchildren and nieces and nephews, who think the world always had technology. They can't imagine one without it. Many of the digital class reside in urban areas of our state where salaries are higher, because once upon a time, technology was far more expensive than it is today. And they also have affordable access to broadband, a world-class education in technology, an abundance of career opportunities that increase year after year. They are the ones creating this digital divide. And we are now seeing the tangible evidence of the impact of younger generations that grew up with technology. They are the ones adopting and demanding online applications and services in almost every walk of our life. And companies meet this demand because the younger generations represent a growing market of affluent and informed consumers. In the tech industry, we often say, there's got to be an app for that. Because of this increasing demand for almost everything to be online and mobile, many even find love online through Match.com or OkCupid. As a result, these technology advantages create many digital privileges and opportunities not available to other areas of our state, and they should be. Implicitly or explicitly, until the riches and opportunities enabled by broadband are available to everyone, we effectively perpetuate this digital divide. I met with broadband stakeholders all over the state. I believe we can expand these privileges and opportunities beyond urban areas because our state is especially lucky. We have tech-savvy people in many of the communities around our state, ranging from IT to business leaders to super smart techie individuals. Yet their collective knowledge and experience are not shared or harnessed for the greater good. Why is that? The reason is surprisingly simple. Local communities gather around coffee shops and they talk about a variety of issues, but they don't sit there talking tech. They don't know about each other's tech activities as a result, and they operate in silos instead of sharing their knowledge and resources and learning from each other. Our broadband workshops around the state provided a platform to tech, business, and anchor institutions to meet each other and find synergies. I cannot tell you how much energy there is in that room and how many emails and business cards were exchanged as people got very excited about hearing that they were all working on the same issue. Compare this to technology companies that build campuses that provide food, soda, and coffee to encourage and support this kind of interaction and collaboration every minute of every day. They also provide free dry cleaning. Fortunately, the broadband office just announced they have grant funds available to these communities to form some technology planning teams, so I hope the word is out, and I hope you'll be part of sharing that news so that we get as many applications as possible and as many of these teams up and running. This leads me to my second question. Do we know if rural communities are sufficiently digitally literate to access news and information through digital devices? How many of you have noticed that many traditional industries that refuse to adapt to digital technology or try to catch up too late are going extinct? Video stores are displaced by Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and now Google Play is in the market as well. Bookstores are closing because they can't compete with the ease and the convenience and the discounts offered by Amazon or iTunes. And I love buying from bookstores. I was recently in Hawaii for my kids, read The Hunger Games, was completely addicted to this trilogy, went several places to find the other books at bookstores, and I was told in Hawaii they'd closed down. So luckily I had my iPad with me, so I bought it online and downloaded and read the trilogies on the beach in Hawaii. Encyclopedia Britannica, the oldest source of the world's information in English, is no longer going to be in print. They're only going to be available online now. And the $1,400 price tag for that 32 volume in print is now going to cost $70 per year online. They also built applications so that you can just download specific information for $1.99. So what does the trend for everything to be online mean for people's access to news and information? Well, first, studies show that people's first preference for the source of news and information is the reputation or the brand. This is a very traditional way to make decisions, and this is good news for the local media. The idea of recommendations and targeted ads haven't quite had the same impact as reputation and brand. Studies also find that providing people with easier access to news and information is increasing the demand for it when it is made available to them throughout their day. This is also good news. For example, and everyone in this room, I'm sure, have done this. You access your news and information when you're standing in line for coffee. You also check your information or access your news in between meetings. Or I'm seeing a lot of nodding heads here. Or when we wait to pick up our children from school, and when we attend events in this, like this today. In the meantime, people are also increasing their use of technology devices. I've shown you mine, but let's look at the rest of the world. So you see the jump and increase in cell phones. I'm hoping that this slide might be included in your broadcast. But we have the growth in cell phone use across all the age demographics, desktop computers, laptop computers, game consoles, e-readers, and tablets are new to the market, but they are growing really fast. And then it's really the oldest generation that have none of these devices because it's not relevant to them at the stage in their life. This huge use of digital devices means ad revenues. That's the lifeblood for traditional media. So they're going to be migrating to the web and mobile, and they already have started that process with varying degrees of success. This is an opportunity for local media as well, but it's a problem if their content is not available online and works with these devices and is also mobile. How many people get their news online? 78% of people get their news on laptops and desktops. 34% of these people also access their news on their smartphones, and 27% access their news on tablets. And this is just growing. As a result of people wanting their news and information online from wherever they are, many major newspapers have been losing $10 in print for every dollar they gain online. They gain from going online. In 2010, they were losing $7 in print. So there's been an even more dramatic drop. Media companies used to believe that people would want to have their information online sometimes, but not all the time. Traditional news media is now shrunk to 43% since 2000. So what's going online next? I'm crossing my fingers and voting for catalogs because they jam up my mailbox all the time, and we get so many of them, and they're so thick. So here's a little bite I'd like to highlight. Last summer, my 501c3 nonprofit, Move It Online, MEO, we surveyed the online use at Pike Place Market. There's 507 vendors there. They have 10 million visitors a year from all over the world as well as locally. They're based in downtown Seattle, and they have affordable access to broadband, not as much wireless as they need. 35% of the vendors were not online, and the quality of the online presence of many of these vendors were nowhere near best practices of today. In fact, many of the websites, when they had one, gave you a phone number and said, call us. But they feel the pressure to go online. They told us, they are asked 10 to 20 times every day, are you online? Are you on Facebook? Do you tweet? Because I want to know about the chanterelle mushrooms when they come in, because it's a seasonal product, especially for the chefs in town. I was struck by the fact that the vendors had exactly the same reasons for not going online or using it very often as the communities and rural areas of our state. And you can get more details about this story on our website at meononprofit.org. The reasons are they didn't grow up with technology and they don't understand its value. They don't have access to broadband in certain areas of the market because it's multiple levels and it's an old building, so there's density issues that don't allow radio waves to go through. And they don't have the time and resources to support it. And most importantly, they don't want to fail. They want to upset their customers if they don't use it well because they see it as an extension of them. This resistance to people to adopt technology when they did not grow up with it creates a culture that effectively supports a privileged digital elite. If we don't, one, overcome this age generation gap and bring along the people that didn't grow up with technology so they are not left behind, and we need to recognize the real human factor of the fear of failure, that people need to be supported when they first learn technology because they have their pride and their reputation at stake, which they put online by going online. So a creative solution that I'd like to suggest that how we solve this is to leverage our local assets and talents. We all know, oh, pardon me, I forgot to show you the slide about all the spending in traditional media, in the print, in terms of how much is spent on traditional media versus the time that's actually spent on print media versus web and mobile. So the red arrows are showing where we think the ad revenues will be going. So we all know change is hard, especially as people get older. But as with all challenges, it can be overcome by working together. And so here are my ideas. First, identify all these digital assets that we have around the state and start talking and socializing with each other about them. Second, gather the data and show the impact and influence of technology to people who don't understand technology but are influential in your state, including your legislators. You don't have to influence this legislator. He already gets it. And collect these statistics and these facts and these stories. And we, in our nonprofit, we created a library where we've been collecting all these real stories about the benefits of broadband and reports and studies and infographics. So you can go ahead and access them. They're free. We did this to be helpful. And lastly, use the model that we are putting out there, which is leverage your tech-savvy youth through paid internships and let them provide digital media one-on-one workshops for their communities. And this way, not only do they learn about the issues in their communities, but they can actually learn about leadership and being a change agent and having impact themselves, which is what we need from our youth in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John McCoy, you look at this issue from both a 30,000-foot level and a grassroots level. Is there a divide? Is there a digital elite, and are others being left behind?
Yes, there are. It comes quite apparent every day. You know, it continues to grow. Frustration for me is that, you know, in getting broadband out to rural areas, you know, I'm a strong believer that economic development follows those trucks that are laying the fiber down the highway. They're following it, and they're getting into businesses out there because that's what happened at Tulalip, where I live. It's an Indian reservation, and quite a number of you know how well the economic development is done there, but I would not have been able to get that done if I had not first put in the infrastructure of broadband. Would have never happened. So, in looking at the problem statewide, there are, you know, besides the incumbent big utilities on how they keep looking at the bottom line on determining whether they're going to go into an area or not, but we also have issues with local governments and some of the ordinances that they have in place, and that they're their own worst enemy on some of the deployments around the state. So we have to also educate the local governments that some of these rules they put in place hinder economic development, and they need to modify those rules, not only for broadband, but for also alternative energy. Broadband and alternative energy resources almost go hand in hand. So So watching how things are done around the state, yes, I see. You can be a community of medium means, but you could be very rich in technology. Or you could even be almost a poor community, but rich in technology. So it all balances, kind of balances out, and it's all in the eyes of the beholder on whether how you feel about yourself. And as I've talked with the various utilities and with Angela and some of the other nonprofits, you know, I keep telling them that you need to go out and educate. You may put Verizon, may put an asset out there. Okay, they put it out there, and now they're sitting there waiting for people to come. Well, those folks out in that community, 9 out of 10 times, do not know the question to ask. What does this do for me? So there's got to be an education module. When they put an asset out there, they have to educate the community so that they understand what they have in their midst then and how it can help them. So there is that educational, of which then again also leads to the local government to educate them so they modify their local ordinances to allow for broadband to be brought in. And it's not only local government. The Colville tribe has got an issue with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They, CenturyLink needs to renew a lease, and the BIA is not allowing the lease to be renewed to a cable cabinet. So that's a local issue with a federal twist to it that needs to be fixed.
Yeah. Milt, what kinds of, beyond what Representative McCoy mentioned, what kinds of issues do you and Dan and the others from the tech industry run into when you try to move into markets?
Well, Representative McCoy mentioned, I think, what siting issues for mobile, you know, providers is a big issue. You know, in terms of just the ability to build to serve the communities, there's a countervailing, you know, pressures, whether the local community wants a site, you know, or not. And at this point, that is a preventative, you know, thing now in some cases. Spectrum, which you'll hear probably, you know, I know from Dan as well, is a big issue. At the federal level, spectrum policy, opening up spectrum to take care of what is this growing demand for, as Frieda mentioned, speed. That's the next, you know, divide, I guess, if you will. And you know, those are, you know, the other, I guess, big problem that we on a daily basis face at the state level is that the regulations that are in place are geared toward the monopoly telephone system of the past, not what's happening now, which is thriving competition. You know, at, you know, some of these, I looked at the map recently, the broadband offices map, where I grew up in Southwest Washington, a little town of 300, across the river from Astoria, Oregon. 8 providers over 3 megs. That was amazing, you know, to me, in rural areas. So, I mean, the competition is there, and I think that the regulatory structure must recognize that. So just a few of the ways. So when you talk about partnering between companies and governments, one of the things, I think the big ones that I would say is, look, the best partnership for us is to, you know, pardon me, stay out of the way. You know, in many cases, let us continue to do what we're doing, which is to build, you know, into this market. So I don't know if Dan has anything to add, but those are some.
Well, on the local side, local governments really do call the shots when it comes to building permits and zoning requirements. And we do have facilities that are, quite frankly, intrusive in the community. You and of course, everybody wants the service. They don't necessarily want the infrastructure that goes with it. And so you always have issues over cell towers, primarily, because that's the technology that allows us to broadcast our signals and connect people. And so one of the things we've tried to do is work really closely with cities and counties to create balanced local ordinances so that allows us to roll out our technology that the people want. And that's one of the points we really make with a city, an elected city council, is that your constituents want this technology. So you can't just say no. But let's find a way to work together, put together a balanced ordinance to minimize the intrusiveness of those facilities and still provide the service that people want. It's an especially big deal right now because all of us are upgrading those facilities to LTE technology, which is the next big leap in wireless broadband. And a lot of those are just simple upgrades to existing sites. And so we're talking with a lot of local governments now about a streamlined process for that so that we can make those improvements, get that new technology out to people as fast as we can. And again, it's a fairly minimal visual impact on the community. And so it's a huge challenge for us right now, probably the biggest one we have from a policy standpoint for getting LTE out to people.
Tom, how much opposition, how cooperative do you find these small towns when you move in?
You know, the small towns are pretty open to it. They are not the ones that have issues with right-of-ways and permits. They're embracing it. Where we run into the problem is in some of the larger urban cities. And specifically, an example that comes to mind for me is in Seattle. Over the last 3 to 4 years, we've had about 90% of our sites that we wanted to do infrastructure work and do some placement of cabinets and things like that, that we've had to have been rejected, that we've had to take that money elsewhere and go do investments. So we try to work with it, but Representative McCoy hit it right on the head. We've got to work with local cities and state governments. The local cities on the permitting because we're not doing, you know, to be less intrusive and try to make it there. So it's not just rural. Urban is probably more of our problem from a permitting standpoint.
Is that in part because people say, well, you know, you've already got so damn many towers here, et cetera, we don't need more?
For us, it's not towers. We do provide fiber optic services to the towers, so sometimes we run into problems getting service to them. Really what we're doing is it's in the neighborhood. And you get in an urban environment, you know, people have 150, 200-foot lot, you know, to try and put another piece of a cabinet out on the right-of-way or to try and get an easement from them is a little bit difficult because they're already feeling constricted because of the closeness.
Christy Kirkpatrick. This issue of education in the community, you have your foot, Colfax Librarian, you have your foot in all of these small communities along with Colfax. Is there a problem of education? Do people intrinsically know this, or do they need to be taught it?
Both, I would say. And my head is spinning listening to everybody speak, because in libraries we see so many sides of this issue. As the way information is coming out and it's changing, and, you know, so much is online now. And that's how, as a library, we know that's the way that we're going to now be sharing information with our patrons and our customers and our communities. But for us, the problem we're seeing is when the technology's not keeping up with it, we're going to conferences learning this is the way that you're going to now give your people their learning experiences, their news, their this sort of thing. I get home and say to my tech guy, we've got to do this. And he says, people can't access this from home. How we set up our websites, so much of what we do is determined by the technology. I agree with a few of you that have said, if the technology is there, the digital literacy will follow. We're in our rural areas waiting for that. And I think, and I agree also with Representative McCoy that those people follow that technology. We're slowly seeing people move into our rural areas wanting to do business and telecommuting and some of those opportunities, but getting that technology to our towns and our rural areas has just been a huge struggle. Our library, and it's pushed us into a place I haven't really wanted to be, because we're seeing that we can really be a way to help our towns get that technology. We're participating in a big statewide multi-million-dollar grant, and we're doing those things to bring the technology as best we know how, but it's not necessarily an area of expertise for us. So we're sort of going in blindly and making decisions that I hope that this is a good grant we're involved in, and I hope we're doing this right, because I think our communities and the people that we serve, so many people depend on libraries for their information, and they're depending on us. And so I hope that we're making good choices and positive difference and trying to do that.
Do you find, you say so many people depend on our libraries, I mean, it's kind of a counterintuitive thing, I think, particularly for urbanites, that, you know, why have libraries anymore at all when we can get the Encyclopedia Britannica online in a $1.99 app?
Well, when you see a commercial on TV that you can now do this online, you have to do this online. You have to fill out your Social Security, your new retirement system. As everything moves online, you have so many people, for one, who don't even know how to go online, let alone have that access. And so we are busier than ever. Traditional book circulation dropping, online use going through the roof, but I think the biggest thing we're seeing is people in needing help. You know, apparently I can only get this through the internet. Can you show me how? We're going out to the schools, helping them with research classes. How do I sift through this overload of information? How do I get a good, reliable resource? A lot of things have fallen to libraries that nobody else has stepped in. And when you talked about taking the technology out there and then teaching people what that means to them, that's kind of what we're doing, but I would love the help. I mean, we're busier with different things than people realize, I think, now.